Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We look at U.S. policy towards Iran in the context of U.S. elections with Ivan Eland, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. He has been Director of Defense Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, Principal Defense Analyst at the Congressional Budget Office, Evaluator in Charge, National Security and Intelligence for the U.S. General Accounting Office, and Investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He has also testified on the military and financial aspects of NATO expansion before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and CIA oversight before the House Government Reform Committee. Ivan Eland, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
During the past year, we've heard some deeply troubling reports from journalist Seymour Hersh and others about a potential U.S. or Israeli strike on Iran. Would you say there is still a potential for such a policy?
Well, I think, you know, anytime you've got an election, a key election, not necessarily just in 2006, but in 2008, the possibility is there. The other problem that we have, and presidents have used this in the past, starting one war to take the mind of the nation off the war that isn't going so well. Ronald Reagan did this in the early 80s. He embarked on this disastrous peacekeeping mission in Lebanon, which got 241 Marines killed in the Marine barracks, and he was going to withdraw the troops. So he invaded Grenada about the same time, after telling the British, the former British colony, that he wasn't going to do that. And so Margaret Thatcher wasn't too happy about that at the time. But this is an example of, you know, diverting the attention. So I think any time we've got both elections coming up and the fact that the Iraq war is not going too well, there is, a better than even chance that we'll see an attack on Iran sometime. It may not be this fall, but it may be next year or even the following year in 2008. So the Republicans are trying to stress their national security credentials, and frankly, I think that's a bad strategy for them because it's sort of like leading with your jaw in boxing. I mean, there's a new poll out that shows that 60% of the public thinks that the Iraq war will increase terrorism rather than decrease it. So, you know, the Democrats have a lot of ammunition to fire back now that they didn't have before, and so a war with Iran might, you know, erase that and continue the Republicans on the path of being the national security party if they can show that Iran is a threat and the administration is attacking Iran, even if the attack really doesn't do much, which, of course, it probably wouldn't.
Now, you're an expert, really, on sanctions, and economic sanctions as a foreign policy tool was the topic of one of your books, right?
Yes, defense and national security is my main area, and sanctions is sort of a secondary area that I'm interested in. I'm interested in all types of coercive policy, both economic and military.
And there has been renewed discussion of sanctions in the wake of this deadline having passed for Iran. What do you make of where things stand and what has been expressed thus far by Chinese and Russian leaders as well as leaders within NATO and the UN?
Iran is now making, again, overtures of negotiation, but they won't follow the UN requirement of suspending their uranium enrichment because they say, and of course they're right, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they have a right to do that as long as they're not making bombs. And so far, no one can prove that they are making bombs. So they're standing pat in defiance of the United Nations Security Council. So even if there are sanctions, I don't think it's really going to be too effective because Iran is under a lot of U.S. sanctions already and sanctions from other countries. And the problem with economic sanctions is the economic effects dissipate over time. You have to have very discreet and humble objectives if you want to use economic sanctions to achieve them. Getting a country to give up its nuclear program by use of these sanctions, it probably isn't going to work. In fact, there probably won't even be very strong economic sanctions passed on Iran as far as multilateral sanctions through the UN, simply because, as you mentioned, Russia and China are opposed to that. They have a lot of oil interests in Iran, and they don't want, and a lot of commercial interests, and they don't want to make Iran angry. Second of all, the United States had better be careful when it puts its sanctions on, because the only meaningful sanctions would be sanctions on Iran's oil industry. And very frankly, the Republicans are trying to get elected in a year that doesn't look too good for them. And if oil prices go back up because oil sanctions against Iran, that's going to really hurt. So you won't see sanctions against oil. And in fact, that's really the only meaningful sanction that they could probably put on. So you'll see symbolic sanctions such as, you know, banning the travel of Iranian nuclear officials. And of course, you know, that's ridiculous because the Iranian nuclear officials aren't really allowed outside the country because they're afraid that they'll defect and that sort of thing. And what usually happens with economic sanctions, they'll sanction the stuff that really doesn't matter very much as a symbolic action to show their displeasure with Iran. But the sanctions probably won't have that much effect, even if they're put on.
And would you say that politics, again, are important in that at least some of the senators running in tough campaigns this time around are for sanctions and are hoping for sanctions to take place because this will strengthen their argument that, again, they are strong and powerful in the war on terror? Talk about that a little bit, and also in the context of what you have written lately about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and his renewed strength, really, overall. In the past 6 months, he appears to be gaining strength in the region, right?
Well, Iran has gained strength in the region as a whole simply because they can stir up a lot of trouble in Iraq for the United States. And very frankly, the U.S. invasion of Iraq is probably going to be one of the major strategic blunders of the 21st century, I think. Although it's a young century yet, we don't know what's going to happen. But it made Iran a 400-pound gorilla into an 800-pound gorilla because it took its primary enemy away, and that was Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And Iran has a lot of influence in southern Iran and over the government of Iran, and Ahmadinejad is the president. Now, of course, he doesn't control everything in Iran. The mullahs run the security issues and other issues, but he's certainly an active president, and he has gained in power, and Iran has gained in power in the region. And of course, this is going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. But I believe the U.S. attacked Iran, very frankly, the pro-Western population in Iran would immediately be driven to support the government that they don't support now. And so I think if the Bush administration wants change in Iran, an attack would be disastrous because it would throw all these young people who like Western culture and economic freedom and that sort of thing, they would be driven right into the hands of the mullahs.
Talk about that in the context of the president's statements about the war on terror. We're safer, but not yet safe. He has been basically establishing the territory that will be the territory for the elections, and that is, of course, national security, the war on terror. If the U.S. does not impose strong sanctions, and if there's not much difference in terms of anything diplomatically or militarily between the U.S. and Iran come election time, what does that mean to this president? And do you think this will sort of be the signal the downturn of the rhetoric on the war on terror in general?
Well, I think if it's a loser for them in the election, you won't see it as much anymore. But right now, it's about all they've got. People are mad about high gas prices. They're mad about the Iraq war. They're mad about the immigrant. Many immigrants are mad about their immigration issue, et cetera. So the national security issue, excluding Iraq, I think, is their main, their main campaign issue. And I think threatening Iran and making an enemy out of Iran could help them in that regard, because Iran sponsors various groups. Now, of course, what's never said is that the groups that Iran sponsors don't really focus their attacks on the U.S. They focus their attacks on Israel. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and Hezbollah are all focused on Israel, and those are the groups that Iran supports. And so I think, this is stretching it a little bit to make Iran a current threat, the same way Iraq was stretched to make it an imminent threat before the war, before the invasion. Iran is probably at least 5 years away from getting a nuclear weapon, which gives the West some time to negotiate with Iran and that sort of thing. And as I mentioned, an attack will not get all the facilities because they don't know where they all are. And in fact, what it will do is it will embolden Iran to try to get nuclear weapons in secret because to keep the U.S. from launching an invasion of Iran, because that's what the Iranian government will be scared of if the U.S. Does airstrikes. This can play into the election campaign because it's another, even if they don't attack Iran before the election, they could certainly say, well, you know, there are continuing dangers out there and Iran is sponsoring terrorism and, you know, they were part of the axis of evil and that sort of thing. And so we've still got to be aware and be vigilant about this. And the Republicans are the party to keep in power, given the fact that this threat is still out there. Would you trust the Democrats to do the good job against Iran, the Iranian threat?
The U.S., just speaking of Iraq right now, seems to be really struggling to hold portions of Iraq, particularly in Ramadi and Al-Anbar province. If the rhetoric again starts to look like the U.S. against Al-Qaeda in Iraq and that Iran is funding terrorists in Iraq, we could be watching an unstoppable train at some point, right? If this starts to heat up to the point where shutting it down makes the present administration and members of Congress like Santorum perhaps start to look ridiculous.
Yeah, I think how the administration might play that is that Shiite Iran is funding Shiite militias and death squads in Iraq, and the Al-Qaeda's are Sunnis. But the basic argument that you're making is true. They may say that Iran is sabotaging U.S. efforts in Iraq through these Shiite militias, death squads, etc., and therefore Iran's an insidious threat. It's not giving up its nuclear program. It's enriching uranium to make weapons. It's also supporting anti-Israeli groups. You know, there are several lines of argument that can be made against Iran. You know, the theocratic government in Iran, of course, it's autocratic, and it's not hard to make it into an evildoer. And it's probably just as easy to make the Iranians an evildoer as it was Saddam Hussein. So certainly these regimes are autocratic, but very frankly, we overstated the Iraqi threat, and the Bush administration will probably overstate the Iranian threat for the elections and for just general purposes.
And do you get the sense that he will have at least some support within the Democratic Party in the Senate and the House?
Well, of course, anytime you're up against the foe of Israel, some of the Democrats, like Joe Lieberman, for instance, will support him, you know, because many people in the Democratic Party don't want to run afoul of Israeli lobby and that sort of thing. So I think you will see some support. And, of course, the other reason that Democrats would support it, if you're going to war with a country that's as theocratic and as easily paintable as an evildoer as Iran, it's very dangerous politically for the Democrats not to go along with that. So that's another reason why Bush might use that sort of thing, because, you know, Iran is such a good villain, and it scares the Democrats when we talk about the Iranian nuclear program, we talk about Iranians stirring things up in Iraq, and we also talk about Iranian sponsorship of anti-Israeli groups. So the Democrats, I think, will be a combination of scared to go against Bush and also not willing to go against the Israeli lobby either.
The Middle East is destabilized. Israel is still occupying Lebanon, and peacekeeping troops still not fully in place. And again, there's a potential for further war in Lebanon, which was predicted by at least some people who watched the process at the UN.
Yes, I think we're still in danger of having that deteriorate again back into the war that we had before. I think both sides were willing to make a ceasefire, but of course the underlying issues still haven't been solved. Israel wanted their disarmed Hezbollah and didn't really want to withdraw, and they were forced to do both because they got the short end of the stick in the war. So we still have all these issues, but the Israelis, I think, know that getting rid of Hezbollah is going to be very difficult. And very frankly, I think it's been brought home to the Israeli public and to the Israeli government that the only way they can win a war up there in Lebanon is to completely eradicate Hezbollah, which is very unlikely, because the war is as much political as it is military. And they attributed about two-thirds of Hezbollah's equipment, but, you know, Hezbollah will be resupplied, and Hezbollah is clearly the winner of that war. So the only thing that we can hope for is that Hezbollah needs time to rearm, and the Israelis don't want to get another black eye, so maybe it will hold even though the underlying factors haven't been removed from the problem. But there is a danger that it could go back. I think this, both U.S. invasion of Iraq and the Israeli attack on Lebanon illustrate that using an excuse to go after a regime or a group that you don't particularly like can end up in disaster. And the Israelis follow the exact policies of the Bush administration. The best defense is a good offense. And unfortunately, with terror groups and guerrilla warfare, that strategy does not work. It works against conventional armies, but it doesn't work against guerrillas and terrorists. And therefore, this policy is flawed. And unfortunately, the Israelis followed the American model here, and they reacted to a very small incident of killing two Israeli soldiers and three, kidnapping three Israeli soldiers by Hezbollah, and turned it into a full-fledged war which killed a lot of civilians and certainly diminished Israel's standing in the world, and also, very frankly, reduced the security of its own population up in the north. And I think we're now seeing some of the recriminations of that in Israel. And I think the United States, we ought to ask the same question. Did the invasion of Iraq make us safer? And, of course, no, the answer is no, because we now have more jihadists, and even the U.S. intelligence agencies are worried that Iraq is becoming, you know, a haven and a proving ground and a training ground for terrorists. And, in fact, the president is now resting his defense on the Iraq war, strangely enough, on that this, if we leave now, it will become a haven for terrorists. Well, of course, wasn't any danger of that before he invaded and toppled Saddam Hussein. So it's a remarkable admission by the president that the Iraq strategy has failed.
Well, in that context, you had mentioned Joe Lieberman, veteran U.S. senator from the state of Connecticut, very much involved with AIPAC, the Israeli lobby. I should say Israeli-American lobby. He had said publicly on, I believe it was Face the State, that if Iraq were in a state of civil war, then U.S. forces should pull out. And yet here now we have the Pentagon indicating that we're on the verge, or we might be, and we have certainly chaos prevailing in Baghdad. And again, the U.S. appears to have basically lost control of some parts of Iraq. We all know what that tends to mean, you know, possibly more air attacks.
Certainly, we've spent much too much time in the U.S. press debating on whether we're in a civil war or not. By any empirical standard used by academics who keep track of this, this is a low-grade civil war. You know, talking about the name of it, is we can do that all day, but the real problem is that we're really in a pickle and our forces are held hostage to this conflict. And very frankly, Lieberman is trying to come up with things that will battle his chief challenger. He can't say, well, we've got to pull out immediately. So he says, well, if it gets to be a civil war, we'll pull out, knowing full well that the administration will not admit to a civil war. So he's trying to move toward his opponent, I think, and steal votes away from him with this type of maneuver. But he's not backed off on the war, really, in any sort of significant way.
Right. It was actually kind of an incoherent statement because he had just talked about how essential it was in the war on terror and for all the same reasons he talked about over the years that we stay. And then when asked and pressed about the civil war aspect, said that if there were a civil war, then we should rethink that. So it was kind of a strange position. Let's move on to Iran again, though, and your take on the President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and what if the President of the United States were to debate him?
You know, the Iranians have some point, and to say that they're an autocratic, theocratic regime that doesn't respect human rights and we are a republic, doesn't tell the whole story, because autocratic regimes also have some legitimate security concerns, and republics sometimes go off the course of foreign policy that makes common sense. And I think both of those things are happening in Iran. Even in the worst case, if Iran got nuclear weapons, the United States could deter Iran. We have thousands of nuclear warheads. We have the most potent arsenal on the planet, and they would at most have a few warheads. And right now they don't have a delivery system that would get it to the United States, meaning that their missiles do not have the range to get to the U.S. So the other question is, why would they launch missiles at the U.S. if we left them alone and didn't bother with their affairs as much as we have? And, of course, many Americans, this is in the distant past now, the hostage crisis was in the 80s, and many early 80s, and late 70s, early 80s, and, of course, even then, many Americans were mystified as to why these people were so mad that they were taking over our embassy. They didn't realize that it goes clear back to 1953 when the CIA removed an elected leader from Iran and reimposed the despotic Shah, who had a secret police and who really spent more on weapons than he did on the Iranian people. And that really made the Iranians mad. And at the time of their revolution, of course, they held the Shah responsible, but they also held that he was a puppet of the United States. So there's been long running bad blood between the Iranians and the U.S. And very frankly, many of the young people in Iran are too young to remember that. So I think the U.S. should take advantage of that and try to improve relations with Iran. And, even in the worst case, I'm not saying that Iran getting a nuclear weapon is a good thing, but it's not the worst thing in the world either. We've deterred Maoist China, radical Maoist China, from attacking the U.S. with our arsenal. Any country that has a home address, unlike bin Laden and the terrorists who don't have a home address, any country that has a home address, such as Iran, can be deterred because they know that their whole country will be incinerated by a much larger nuclear arsenal. And so, therefore, I think we can negotiate with the Iranians. Maybe we can convince them to give up their nuclear weapons. But one key element of that would be to guarantee that we would not attack them. But, of course, the United States will not do that because we reserve the right to attack any foe of Israel, and Iran is a foe of Israel. But I think the U.S. should consider saying, okay, Iran, if you get rid of your nuclear program, we will not attack you. Of course, the Iranians would still be worried about Israel with its 200-plus nuclear weapons attacking them. So the Iranians may very well not agree to that deal, but at least the offer should be made, I think. And we may, in the end, have to deal with a nuclear Iran, because bombing them, most of their facilities are underground and hidden. And very frankly, they'll probably get a nuclear bomb unless we invade the country. And if we invaded Iran, it would make the Iraq invasion look like a picnic because of the mountainous terrain. It's a much larger country, population and area-wise. The people would put up a very spirited defense of the place. So I think that the only policy that we have that's workable is really negotiation with Iran, and even that may not work, so we may have to be in the unenviable position of having a nuclear Iran. But that's not catastrophic, I don't think, and it's probably something that we can live with.
Talk about the word fascism and Islamofascism in particular.
Well, this is a very clever ruse. Bush is not the first president to use this. Both the first Bush and Clinton used Hitler as a foil. Whenever we don't like a regime, we compare them to Hitler. Saddam Hussein was compared to Hitler. Milosevic was compared to Hitler. And this is a very subtle way of doing it, by calling the Islamic groups Islamofascists. Fascism is a technical term. It merely means the intertwining of government into business affairs, with the little ultra-nationalism thrown in. And Nazism is an extreme form of fascism. But the real problem here is that the Shiite group Hezbollah has an Islamic agenda. It doesn't have a nationalist agenda. And very frankly, it doesn't even control the government of Lebanon, so it can't very well infuse governmental policy into business affairs when it doesn't control the government. So the Bush administration is trying to compare this with Hitler to show how bad a threat it is. Well, Hitler had a whole lot of money and was trying to tromp all over Europe. These are small groups, and in fact, Hezbollah does not focus its attacks on the United States, as I mentioned. It focuses its attacks on Israel, and therefore, you know, this is hardly a threat on the magnitude of Nazi Germany.
Talk about the degree to which the broad U.S. support for Israel actually makes America less safe in the world.
Well, first of all, we were talking about the Israeli lobby, and really the lobby consists of Jewish groups and also fundamentalist Christian groups, which are far more numerous than the Jewish groups, and they lobby for U.S. support of Israel. But unfortunately, that slavish U.S. support for Israel, we give $300 billion in aid per year. Israel is a rich country, and it should be able to defend itself by now. It has 200-plus nuclear weapons, and it's very capable militarily against conventional armies. Of course, we saw that on a couple of occasions it has lost to Hezbollah, the guerrilla force, because the Israeli army, like the U.S. Army, hasn't really learned how to fight against guerrillas. But Israel still has a very capable military to defend their country, and very frankly, they are wealthy enough to do so. We wouldn't approve of giving millionaires welfare here in the United States whenever they discover some tax loophole or something. There's a wild outcry, but in terms of countries, apparently it's okay to give wealthy countries huge amounts of foreign aid every year, even though they don't really need it. And so therefore, I think that, you know, we ought to reconsider this policy because, very frankly, that's one of the reasons that we're getting the blowback terrorism is because of our support for Israel. And I'm not sure what our support for Israel really does us anymore. The Cold War is over, and if we want oil, we should be nicer to the Arabs rather than the Israelis. So it's true that Israel is a democracy and most of the Arab countries around it are not, but we have to look at our own interests. And it's nice that Israel is a democracy, but does that mean that we need to spend $3 billion per year? Actually, it's over $3 billion to subsidize the defense and the economy of this country.
And do you think that all the support for Israel has made America less safe? I mean, Israel's partnership with America, do you think it works both ways, that because of this strong military alliance, the Arab world and countries like Syria and Lebanon and Iran are going to be more in a military posture than they would be otherwise as far as Israel's real security goes, and that America in the war on terror is weakened, actually, perhaps, what do you think, by our partnership with Israel?
Well, I think it is weakened simply because we don't have very good intelligence in the Middle East. We have to rely on these governments. And even if the governments want to help us, sometimes their populations won't let us because of the hatred of America. And the hatred is generated mainly by our support for Israel. So it does undermine the cooperation of Arab governments, which is critical to rounding up Islamic jihadist terrorists and other types of terrorists that are in the Middle East. So I think there our partnership with Israel is a definite drawback.
Ivan Eland, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ivan Eland of the Independent Institute is assistant editor of the Independent Review. You can read his work online at independent.org. He is also a contributor to many newspapers and magazines, including Middle East Report, Los Angeles Times, USA Today, and many more. Ivan Eland is author of The Empire Has No Clothes, Putting Defense Back into U.S. Defense Policy, and The Efficacy of Economic Sanctions as a Foreign Policy Tool. He is author of 45 in-depth studies on national security issues. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut in Stores, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNation.org and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion.